It's half past eight.
You get a total. The question is muff stamps. If $10 in War Strike will reward you with Lucky Strike. For every question you get this time, you are invited by Lucky Strike to attend its coast-to-coast quiz party. You furnish the questions, and our experts try to answer them. For every question used, Lucky Strike will reward you with $10 in war stamps. If the question is muffed, you get a total of a $50 war bond plus the 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Send your questions to Information, Please, 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. If our editorial staff edits your questions a bit, don't fret over it. In case of similarity, we'll have to be sole judge of who shall be paid, and all questions become the property of Information, Please. And now light up a lucky strike as I present our master of ceremonies, book reviewer of the New Yorker magazine, Clifton Fadiman. Mr. Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, Information, Please continues on its merry way, informal and unprepared as always. And tonight our panel of experts includes our two regulars, Franklin P. Adams and John Kieran. And as our guests, two who have been with us before, the first is Deems Taylor, composer, music critic, and radio personality. And the second is one of our favorite stage and screen stars, who is soon to be seen in They All Kissed the Bride, Mr. Roland Young. Now, before we go any further, I'd like to say that last week we announced at the end of the program that we hadn't missed any questions. I think our fourth birthday must have gone to our collective head. And maybe we're getting a bit too complacent, because we checked the record carefully, and we find that Mr. J. Byrne of New York should have won a set of the Britannicas and a $50 war bond for having stumped the experts with his question about presidents. And speaking of war bonds, may I say just a word about them, ladies and gentlemen. They're not only the wisest investment any American can make, but they're also an urgent, immediate duty. Let me suggest that you visit your bank or other bond outlet without delay and buy as many as you can. Now we're going to begin this evening with a question from Clara S. Velsor of Norwalk, Connecticut, and we're going to get 3 out of 4 if we're good at it. Recite a line of poetry, gentlemen, about the following minor animals: a snail, a moth, a flea, and an ant, in that order. I'm going to begin with snails. Mr. Adams.
Will you walk a little faster, said a whiting to a snail.
Yes, that's a very good one. It's from what poem, Mr. Adams?
It's from, I think, Through the Looking Glass.
I think it is from Through the Looking Glass. Mr. Taylor?
Creeping like a snail unwillingly.
What poem?
Seven Ages of Man.
Yes, from Mr. whom?
Oh, Shakespeare.
Mr. Shakespeare, right. That fixes up snails. How about a moth? A line of poetry in which the word moth appears. Mr. Kieran?
The Moth's Kiss First. From Browning.
What's it from? I don't know.
In a gondola. It's one of those little interpolated songs.
Very good. Can you give us any other with the word moth in it, Mr. Adams?
There's a song, The Moth and the Flame Played a Game One Day.
Very good, Mr. Adams.
The Game of a Woman's Heart.
Oh, very good, Mr. Adams.
A Rolling Stone mine. Gathers no moth.
That's a nice one, Taylor.
Gathers.
Gathered. I said gathered. You like
that? Try that on your lisp, Mr. Adam. How about this one? A flea. Mr. Young.
Here comes the happy bounding flea. You cannot tell the he from she.
By Roland Young.
By Roland Young.
All right, Mr. Young, I think that's one of your little masterpieces. Are there two more lines to it, as I recollect?
Yes. You can't tell he. The sexes look alike, you see, but she can tell, and so can he.
Yes, that's very sly of you. Mr. Adams?
The wicked flee when no man pursueth.
I see that Mr. Taylor has excited you.
Whom no man pursueth?
Remember the, Mr. Kieran, do you remember the quatrain from Jonathan Swift about fleas?
So on ad infinitum, you mean? Yes, remember? Smaller fleas to bite him?
That's the one, remember that? Naturalists observe, a flea hath smaller fleas that on him prey, and these have smaller still to bite him. And so proceed ad infinitum. Now, how about an ant? And, Mr. Adams, just to head you off, I'm going to insist on spelling this A-N-T. None of your nonsense, Mr. Adams.
Go to the ant, thou sluggard. Thank consider you. Her ways and be wise.
Very good, Mr. Adams. Mr. Young, how about another?
Oh, see the busy little ant. Ants. They wear no petticoats, no pants.
And, Mr. Young, isn't that the work of your fertile brain?
What?
That, too, is the work of your fertile brain?
Yes.
From the book called Not for Children.
And a very good book, too.
Now out of print.
Or Young's Night Thoughts.
How about this, gentlemen? From Mrs. Miriam Eckstein of Trenton, New Jersey. If you were served foods that are prepared with the following ingredients, what would you be eating? Here is the first set of ingredients. 1/2 pound of raw ground meat, 1 raw egg, chopped onion, 2 pieces of bread. What is it? Mr. Taylor.
A tartar steak.
A tartar steak. Yeah, Mr. Adams.
A steak tartar if it costs over $1.
Yes. It's funny that it costs so much more if you just put the adjective at the end.
Mm.
Here's another set of ingredients. 1 cup of cooked meat, chopped. 2 potatoes, chopped. 1/2 teaspoon of salt and pepper. Makes what?
Whatever it is.
What does it make, Mr. Taylor?
Very unpalatable.
Oh, heavens, no.
Roast beef hash.
No. What'd you say, Mr.
Hash?
Yes, hash.
Oh.
That is a hash nature or
something. I was right.
Yes. Usually hash has a few other ingredients, but we don't mention them on this program. Now, here is another. 1/4 cup of cocoa, 1 cup of sugar. Oh, that's bad. 1/4 cup of hot water, 1 teaspoonful of vanilla, and 1/4 of cream. What do you get? You sure, Mr. Taylor?
I think so.
What is it?
I think I get fudge.
Oh, nonsense. You don't get fudge at all.
I don't like it. I just said I got it.
You put 1/4 of cream in fudge? Wouldn't it be kind of gooey?
All right.
If you put 1/4 of cream in fudge, you could float
things out. Substitute butter.
Oh, but not. You can't substitute on this program. No, it's
1/4 of cream?
1/4 of cream, Mr. Adams.
I think that'd probably make a gallon of ice cream.
Chocolate ice cream. Yes, quite right. You came in just a little late, Mr. Adams. Whoever, we got 2 out of 3 on that. How about this? This is from Elliot P. Corbin of Metuchen, New Jersey. In what play or novel does a Viennese pose as a Russian? There are going to be 4 of these. A Viennese pose as a Russian, Mr. Taylor.
The Guardsman.
In The Guardsman, that's right. The actor disguises himself as a Cossack prince, I think.
Yes.
Quite right. Now, in what play or novel does an American pose as a Russian? This might be either male or female. I don't mean that exactly. I mean it is either male or female.
Hmm.
Mr. Taylor?
I'm just thinking.
Oh, that's what you were doing.
Yes, that
I couldn't decipher it from your expression.
No, that
was... It's in the play Idiot's Delight by Robert Sherwood. Irina, who is an American girl, poses as a Russian princess. Remember it now, Mr. Taylor, Mr.
Yes,
Young, gentlemen?
Yes. Oh, disturbing.
One
right.
Wrong.
You came from Kansas City.
That's the one. That's right. Now, how about this? In what novel does an Englishman pose as a French woman? An Englishman pose as a French woman. Mr. Kieran.
Scarlet Pimpernel.
In The Scarlet Pimpernel. That's quite right. Yes. What is the disguise, remember?
I've forgotten, really.
Well, it's a sort of an old hag. She's
in a cart.
Yes, in a covered cart. That's right. In what novel does an Englishman pose as a Frenchman? An Englishman pose as a Frenchman. We must get this right or lose a $50 war bond. Ooh. To Mr. Corbin, who is jumping up and down with excitement at the moment. It's in
A Tale of Two Cities.
Yes, but you heard me, didn't you, Mr. Adams?
No, I didn't, but I hadn't read it, and I knew that it was something like that, because my boys have to write compositions on it.
You want me to count that wrong or right? No, I think you didn't get that.
I think he ought to get the dollar.
All right, $50 war bond for Mr. Corbin and a set of the Britannica. How about this? Mrs. Carl Bonds of Washington, D.C. sends this one in. This is a very simple musical question, gentlemen. Quote a line of poetry which mentions the flower that is suggested by each of these musical selections that you're going to hear. There are going to be 3 of them. We have to get 2 out of 3. Let's have the first. Mr. Kahn? Mr. Taylor had his hand up at once. Mr. Taylor?
To a Wild Rose by Edward McDowell.
Now, we have to have a line of poetry involving the rose. Mr. Taylor, that's the assignment.
Poetry.
A line of poetry. You didn't listen.
Any rose?
Certainly not.
Any rose, yes.
Oh, my love's like the red, red rose.
That's a very good one.
She isn't wild.
It doesn't have to be
you
wild.
You don't know her.
Mr. Kieran?
Well, I sometimes think that never blows the so red the rose from the Omar.
From Omar Khayyam, yes. Any of those would do.
Any other name.
That's a very good one, Mr. Young. Rose by any other name. Or
Rose O'Day.
Or Rose O'Day, yeah. All right, how about the next selection? Now, remember, you have to not only identify it, but give us a line of poetry
using the same flower in the title. Right, Mr. Carr? Is that selection familiar to any of you gentlemen? Mr. Adams, not familiar? Mr. Taylor, does it come back to you with a...
I wish Levant were here. Yes, he wouldn't know it.
Yeah, he probably would know it.
He would?
Yeah, I think so. It's Mozart's Das Veilchen, the violin.
Oh, the violin. I never did like
well,
it.
Well, I'm going to count you wrong on that, but give me a line of poetry with the word violin. It surely...
Every morning I bring the violins.
Yes.
By a mossy stone, oft hidden from the eye.
Yes, the well-known mossy stone violet. Mr. Kieran, have any other?
The forward violet, thus did I chide.
Oh, that's a pretty one. What's it from?
Shakespeare.
Okay. Why should you think that I should know that, Mr. Kieran?
Well,
and now,
sonics.
The third and last. Does the melody ring a bell in that brain of yours, Mr. Taylor?
I'll not have my brain bandied about like this. Yes, well, it rings a bell, but a very cracked one.
Very small one. Well, it's a song called Janine, I Dream of Lilac Time.
Oh, I'm glad I didn't know that.
You don't know that one? Mr. Kieran, how about...
When lilacs last in the dooryard.
Yes, and Mr. Adams, you have another
one? Q in Lilac Time.
Yes, or Mighty Lilac Arose. Anyone else? Well, we got two wrong on that. That sends a $50 war bond to Mrs. Barnes and a set of the encyclopedia. I'm lucky to get away with that one. How about this from Miss Edna West of Austin, Texas? Get two out of three. Gentlemen, you're to imagine that you find yourself in England, short of certain articles of clothing, and you enter a shop, and you ask for the following articles of clothing. Suspenders, a vest, and knickers. If you put them on, what would you be wearing? Mr. Adams?
You'd be wearing braces.
You'd be wearing what? Now, you ask, you are an American, Mr. Adams.
Oh, yes.
And you go in, and in your American, funny American way, you ask for suspenders, a vest, and knickers. And you put them on. That's the funny part. And what are you wearing, Mr. Taylor?
I see.
Does it come to you?
I think I know what you'd be wearing if you wore knickers.
What would you be wearing?
Can I say on the air?
Yeah, I'm afraid you have to.
Well, you'd be a gentleman, wouldn't you?
Well, in a small way.
Well, you wouldn't be wearing... You'd be wearing ladies' clothes.
Yes, but that's rather vague. Even I know that ladies have more than one kind of clothes. What sort of clothes would they be?
Underclothes.
No.
Yes, they would.
No.
Air warden clothes or something
No. Now, knickers, if you asked for knickers in London, you would get a pair of bloomers. Now, bloomers
well,
are not...
That's what I said.
No, they're sort of semi-underclothes. Underneath bloomers, there are sometimes
not
even
anymore.
More clothes.
Not anymore.
I don't think that's right.
You don't think so, Mr. Young?
No, not necessary.
What would you get if you asked for knickers?
Well, you might get knickerbockers.
Say, that's a mess. If you ask for knickers, you'd get knickers?
Shorts.
Yes.
That's very confusing. I thought you would have to ask for plus fours if you wanted to...
No.
You wouldn't?
Oh, no. I used to wear knickerbocker long before plus four as I mentioned.
Well, this is a very old question. It was made up in 1921.
You better stay home, kid.
That still leaves us with vests and suspenders. Now, if you asked for a vest, what would you get? Mr. Young?
You'd get an undershirt.
You'd get an undershirt, yes. What should you ask for if you're in London and you wanted a vest?
A waistcoat.
A waistcoat, Mr. Adams. Quite right. How do you spell waistcoat, Mr. Adams?
W-E-S-K-I-T.
How about suspenders? Now, if you asked for suspenders, what would you get?
Garters.
You would get garters, Mr. Young. Yes. What are suspenders in England? What are...
Braces,
yes. Well, that gives us at least two out of three. And I'll take up that bloomer question with you after the program, Mr. Taylor.
How about this one?
From Nancy Gaines of Buffalo. Here, gentlemen, is a menu from Gilbert and Sullivan. Name the operetta in which each course is found. Now, the first course is a rather tough worm, sort of hors d'oeuvre. Mr. Kieran.
That was served to the Dickey Bird, Titwillow.
Yes,
sang Titwillow.
Yes, in which operetta is that?
Mikado.
In the Mikado, yes, quite right.
Thank you.
How about mixed pickles?
You were going to say that.
Mixed pickles? In what operetta would you find mixed pickles served to you? Mr. Kieran?
I think that is in HMS Pinafore.
No, sorry.
Oh,
well,
no.
So am I.
Oh, I'm sorry it isn't.
Might be in Princess Ida, but I don't know. I don't know where...
No, it is from Iolanthe. It's the Lord Chancellor who sings the song When You're Lying Awake with a Dismal Headache and so forth.
Oh, I never
remember it. First your counterpane goes and uncovers your toes and your sheet slips demurely from under you. Then the blanketing tickles. You feel like mixed pickles. Does that come back to you at all, Mr. Adams?
I never listened up to that part.
Just the first three lines, eh? Well, that gives us one wrong. How about this? Bottled beer and chops. You'd find that course in what operetta? Bottled beer and chops. Mr. Taylor?
I'm a little intimidated now, but I'm pretty sure that Little Butter Club cup.
In
those in Pinafore.
No, it is
not
in
bottled beer.
No, no.
Can't we get work Pinafore into this?
No, not unless I continue with this question for another 10 minutes. Patience, it is. Conceive me if you can, an everyday young man who is fond of his dinner and doesn't get thinner on bottled beer and chops. Am I wrong, Mr. Taylor?
Apparently I'm sure.
That's it. That sends a $50 war bond to Miss Gaines and a set of the Britannica. And I must say that you are making up for last week, gentlemen.
Prodigal, let's see.
Now, so far, Lucky Strike has paid out three of these $50 war bonds and three sets of the Britannica. And now Mr. Cross points out that procrastination, the thief of time, is also robbing many people of smoking enjoyment.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, perhaps you've been intending to try Lucky's, but then you keep putting it off. If so, you may be missing something. For make no mistake, in a cigarette, it's the tobacco that counts. Better tobacco means more mildness, better taste, a finer cigarette all round. And smokers, Lucky Strike means fine tobacco. At market after market, year after year, we consistently pay the price to get the better quality leaf. For example, in Greenville, Tennessee, at auctions of the 1939 crop, the American Tobacco Company paid 26% more for the tobacco it bought for its cigarettes and other tobacco products. Yes, 26% above the average market price published by the United States Department of Agriculture. And that crop, properly aged, mellowed, and blended with other fine crops, is in the Luckies you buy today. Mr. Fadiman, don't these facts call for action now?
Timely is the word for them, Mr. Cross. And you said your say in just 56 seconds. You know, Mr. Taylor, I'm still worried about those bloomers. Aren't those the things that women wear when they're playing basketball? Aren't those bloomers?
No, they wear shorts now.
Oh, all right. I give up, then. I just don't know. I just can't keep up with things. How about this
one?
You
don't study the picture, Mr.
This is from Charles Nordland, Jr. of Philadelphia. This is about reformed characters in literature. Why did these characters reform? Mrs. Cheney. Why did Mrs. Cheney reform? Mr. Young.
Love.
Ah, yes, I beautifully say that, Mr. Young. What was the situation there, briefly? Do you remember it at all?
Not very well.
Roland was a romantic duke, wasn't he?
I've forgotten. Does she win out at the end?
She gives it all up at the end because she fell in love with me.
Oh, Mr. Young.
As luck would have it.
As luck would have it.
A historical instance of miscasting.
I should like to remind you, Mr. Young, that all the plugs on this program are by Mr. Milton Cross. That's correct. Mrs. Cheney, in the last of Mrs. Cheney, Mr. Lonsdale's play, reformed for love, and she proved her regeneration by tearing up money that she had received as a bribe. Does that come back to you,
yeah,
now, Mr. Young? How about this? Soapy reformed for what reason? Gosh, first you have to know who Soapy is.
Soapy?
Soapy, S-O-A-P-Y.
Soapy.
Does that make it clearer, Mr. Taylor?
You don't mean Soapy Sam Wilberforce.
No, I don't. He never reformed.
That's
Soapy,
right.
Sam Wilberforce. Soapy is a character in one of the stories of O. Henry, in The Cop and the Anthem. Does that recall the... Does that... Well, Soapy is a tramp, and he listens to church music, and the sound fills him with remorse and a desire to reform. It's at that point that a cop comes along and arrests him for loitering and sends him over to the island for a year. Did that come back to you now, Mr. Kieran? Very good story. Got it wrong, too. How about Jean Valjean? He reforms for what reason, Mr. Kieran?
Because Bishop Myriel convinces him of that it's better to be a good man than a bad man.
Yes, that's quite right. How about this question? This comes from Bell R. Witkin of Springfield, Massachusetts. It's another musical question, gentlemen, which I hope you'll do better on. Each of these selections accompanies the description of a journey. What places are mentioned? Get 2 out of 3, and let's have the first, Mr. Carn. Mr. Adams?
The places mentioned are Alabama and Louisiana.
Yes, which is
I
from...
I come from Alabama, my true love for to see.
I think you got your states mixed up. He comes from Alabama with his banjo on his knee, and he's going to Louisiana.
His true love for to see.
That's right, yes. The love is in Louisiana. It's only fair to the inhabitants of Louisiana to make that clear. Now the
her
second...
Her name happens to be Susanna, something I don't know what.
Oh, Susanna.
Just O, period, as Susanna.
O.
That was Anna. Susanna must be your last name.
Right.
Mr. Carn? Mr. Kieran?
From the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli,
yes.
The U.S. Marines.
You bet. The Marines Hymn by Phillips. Now the third and last, Mr. Carn. What places are mentioned in the course of the journey described in this lovely song?
Is there a city called Knee Pants?
Knee Pants?
That's where you live.
No,
that's
no.
Where she lived. That's where he lived.
No, not Knee Pants.
Knee Pants, Alabama.
Oh, come, come. There's no such place as Knee Pants, Alabama, Mr. Adams. Mr. Taylor?
I don't take with this popular.
Oh, now, come, come. It's one of the best popular songs written in the last couple of years.
I know.
And the words are good, too.
Yes.
And you don't
about
know.
About the mother's advice.
Pardon?
It's about the mother's advice, but where it was given.
Yes, you remember the morals, but the moral, but your geography is weak. From Natchez to Mobile, from Memphis to St. Joe, wherever the four winds blow, that does not come back.
Oh, I heard a man answer that on a quiz question last night.
Only you don't retain for 24 hours, do you, Mr. Taylor? Still, you got 2 out of 3 on that. How about this one? From Alice M. McLean of Briarwood, Long Island. What unusual power was possessed by the following people? Get 2 out of 3. The first is Sam Small. An unusual power possessed by Sam Small. Mr. Adams?
Flying in the air.
Yes, who was Sam Small?
Sam Small is, as Mr. Eric Knight said, a generic term. But Sam Small was a flying Yorkshireman.
Yes, in the famous stories by Mr. Knight. How about Clark Kent? Clark Kent.
Clark Kent, a comic strip.
Why, Mr. Young, you're the first man we've had on this program who ever read comic strips. I'm very glad. Who is Mr. Clark Kent?
Well, he changes into Superman.
Yes, that's right.
Has infinite power of every kind.
Yes, he can do practically anything.
Yes.
That's right. When he is merely Clark Kent, he is what?
He's a reporter, a newspaper.
Yes, a simple newspaper man. Just tell that to Mr. Adams, Mr. Kieran. I understand there's been a lot of trouble lately about Superman because the boys and girls who listen have written in to ask why he hasn't joined the army and cleaned up the Japs and the Germans. That's true. Did you know that, Mr. Adams?
No.
Well, he's working on a Japanese spy now, I think.
No, I understood that in one sequence, it was made clear that Mr. Kent, rather Superman, has X-ray eyes. He can't see things, but he can only see through them, so they turned him down on a kind of eye trouble, and he couldn't get through. How about Rima? What unusual power was possessed by Rima, Mr. Kieran?
Well, Rima was the girl, of course, in Green Pastures, and she could...
Not Green Pastures.
the Green Mansion.
Yes.
Green Mansion by W.H. Hudson.
Yes.
And she could... she could make herself practically invisible and also climb, run all over trees and bound from limb to limb like a bird.
She could chirp like a bird,
yes,
too.
She could talk to birds.
That's right.
Yes, which is... Mr. Kieran can do that practically. Mm-hmm. How about this one, which is off the record, gentlemen? You whether you get this right or wrong doesn't matter. What unusual power is possessed by George McWhirter Fotheringay? George McWhirter Fotheringay. Mr. Young, I see you trembling.
See the lack of intelligence.
Mr. Young.
Yes. He was given... It was in Wells's book, The Man Who Could Work Miracles.
That's right, yes.
And he was given power by some divinity up above to do stop the motion of the earth.
Yes, that's quite right. It comes back to you with difficulties, considering that you acted the part, Mr. Young. Well, that's all right. Now, we got 4 out of 4 on that. How about this one? This comes from Lloyd Wendt of Chicago. We ought to get all on this. There are 2 parts. Now, follow this carefully, gentlemen. In a report from the scene of battle,
a reporter describes a United States task force as made up in part of the following ships: the Rhode Island, the Boston, the Valley Forge, the Neptune. First, what type of ship is indicated by each of these names? I'll repeat them as, because to make it easier. The Rhode Island would be what type of ship, Mr. Kieran?
All battleships are named after states.
Yes, that's quite right. Therefore, the Rhode Island would be a battleship. Now, the next ship is the Boston, making up a part of this task force. Mr. Taylor?
That would be a cruiser.
That would be a cruiser
named after cities.
Named after American cities.
Like the Marblehead.
Like the Marblehead. And the Valley Forge? The Valley Forge would be what? That's not quite so easy. Mr. Young?
No, not a destroyer.
No, not a destroyer.
Destroyers are named after deceased naval heroes.
Now, how about the Valley Forge?
Couldn't we come back to that?
Might be a tender or something.
No,
like
it's
that.
An aircraft carrier.
Valley Forge?
Valley Forge. I imagine aircraft carriers are perhaps named after events or names famous in our history. How about the Neptune? The Neptune?
That would be a...
Mr. Taylor?
I think that would be a submarine.
Sounds like a submarine.
No.
Fish.
Oh, yes.
They're named after fish, and I don't think a submarine would be part of a task force. I know very little naval matters.
Depends on who made it up.
Now, the Neptune would be a repair ship, and that would have to go along in case it needed repairs. Now, we got two wrong under that, so I'll call that part of the question wrong. How about this? What type of ship did the reporter probably leave out? We've had battleship, cruiser, aircraft, carrier, repair ship. Mr. Kieran.
He left out a destroyer.
He left out a destroyer. And as you said, Mr. Kieran, those are
destroyers are all named after naval heroes, and they have a brass plate with his name on the ship.
That's quite right. Now, if we had gotten 100% on that, I would have passed you, gentlemen, but I'm afraid that getting the Valley Forge and the Neptune wrong will send a $50 war bond to Mr. Wendt and a set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. And now Mr. Cross, who is perhaps thinking in terms of golf this nice weekend, draws a little parallel between golf pros and tobacco pros.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, to improve your game in golf, you'd certainly take the advice of the professionals, wouldn't you? And you know, in smoking, too, you gain by taking a tip from the pros, the independent tobacco auctioneers, buyers, and warehousemen who earn their living in buying, selling, and handling the leaf. At markets all over the South, these experts see just who buys what tobacco. Yes, year after year, they see the makers of Lucky's consistently pay the price to get the finer, milder leaf. For example, in Conway, South Carolina, at auctions of the 1939 crop, we paid 35% more than the average market price published by the United States Department of Agriculture. At Moultrie, Georgia, 47% more, and so on. And that fine tobacco, properly aged, mellowed, and blended with other fine crops, is in the Lucky's you buy today. No wonder that with independent experts, with men who know tobacco best, it's Lucky's 2-1. Smokers, you know that in a cigarette, it's the tobacco that counts. Yes, you know that better tobacco means a better smoke. So why not profit by the experience of the men who know tobacco from A to Z? Smoke the smoke tobacco experts smoke.
Thank you, Mr. Cross. Mr. Morgenthau of the Treasury Department has made four new friends this evening. I can see that because we have paid out four $50 war bonds and four sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. You'll get your citations tomorrow from the Treasury Department, gentlemen. And thank you, Mr. Young and Mr. Taylor, for coming tonight. Next week, Mr. Kieran, Mr. Levant, and Mr. Adams will be on deck. And as our guest, the well-known foreign correspondent and author of the best-selling book, People Under Hitler, Mr. Wallace R. Duell. Remember, listeners, for every question that's answered correctly, the sender gets $10 in war stamps. And for every question that stumps our board, and as you see, it can happen, you get a total of a $50 war bond plus the complete 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Remember to send your letters with questions and the correct answers to Information, Please, at 480 Lexington Avenue, New York City. And now a parting message from Mr. L.A. Speed Riggs, famous tobacco auctioneer from Goldsboro, North Carolina.
That chant, ladies and gentlemen, is your reminder to smoke the smoke tobacco experts smoke. For these independent experts know Lucky Strike means fine tobacco. At market after market, they see us pay the price to get the milder, better-tasting tobacco. That's why, with men who know tobacco best, It's Lucky's 2-1.
Half past eight.
It's 8:30 New York time. Time to wake up America and stump the experts. Each week at this time, you are invited by Lucky Strike to attend its coast-to-coast quiz party. You furnish the questions, and our experts try to answer them.